Greetings from the Audible Local Ledger, located in beautiful Mashpee, Massachusetts, and serving the Cape, the islands, and the South Coast. The Ledger delivers information and entertainment to the print impaired from our Cape-based volunteer readers, as well as from other services around the state, such as the Talking Information Center in Marshfield and the Audio Journal in Worcester. You may sometimes hear their content, but it's the Cape's very own Audible Local Ledger that is broadcasting it. My name is Caroline Paulino, and I'll be reading selections today from Ray Bradbury and Robert Frost. The focus of today's readings is the concept of perceptions, or how we view each other. The first story is taken from Bradbury's collection, The October Country, and it's entitled The Wonderful Death of Dudley Stone. Alive. Dead. Alive in New England, damn it. Died 20 years ago. Pass the hat. I'll go myself and bring back his head. That's how the talk went that night. A stranger set it off with his mouthings about Dudley Stone dead. Alive, we cried. And shouldn't we know? Weren't we the last frail remnants of those who had burned incense and read his books by the light of blazing intellectual votives in the 20s? The Dudley Stone, that magnificent stylist, that proudest of literary lions. Surely you recall the head pounding, the cliff jumping, the whistlings of doom that followed on his writing, his publisher's this note. Sirs, today, aged 30, I retire from the field, renounce writing, burn all my effects, toss my latest manuscript on the dump, cry hail, and fare thee well. Yours affectionately, Dudley Stone. Earthquakes and avalanches in that order. Why, we asked ourselves, meeting down the years, in fine soap opera fashion, we debated if it was a woman that caused him to hurl his literary future away. Was it the bottle? Or horses that outran him and stopped a finer pace in his prime? We freely admitted to one and all that there were Stone writings now. Faulkner, Hemingway, and Steinbeck would be buried in his lava. All the sadder that Stone, on the brink of his greatest work, turned one day and went off to live in a town we shall call Obscurity, by the sea best named The Past. Why? That question forever lived with those of us who had seen the glints of genius in his piebald works. One night, a few weeks ago, musing off the erosion of the years, finding each other's faces somewhat more pouched and our hairs more conspicuously in absence, we became enraged over the typical citizen's ignorance of Dudley Stone. At least, we muttered, Thomas Wolfe had a full measure of success before he seized his nose and jumped off the rim of eternity. At least the critics gathered to stare after his plunge into darkness as after a meteor that made much fire in its passing. But who now remembered Dudley Stone, his coteries, his friendly followers of the 20s? Pass the hat, I said. I'll travel 300 miles, grab Dudley Stone by the pants, and say, look here, Mr. Stone, why did you let us down so badly? Why haven't you written a book in 25 years? The hat was lined with cash. I sent a telegram and took a train. I do not know what I expected, perhaps to find a doddering and frail praying mantis wisping about the station, blown by sea winds, a chalk-white ghost who would husk at me with voices of grass and reeds blown in the night. I clenched my knees in agony as my train chuffed into the station. I let myself down into a lonely countryside, a mile from the sea, like a man foolishly insane, wondering why I had come so far. On a bulletin board in front of the boarded-up ticket office, I found a cluster of announcements, inches thick, pasted and nailed upon one another for unaccountable years. Leafing under, peeling away anthropological layers of printed tissue, I found what I wanted. Dudley Stone for alderman. Dudley Stone for sheriff. Dudley Stone for mayor. On up through the years, his photograph, bleached by sun and rain, faintly recognizable, asked for ever more responsible positions in the life of this world near the sea. I stood reading them. Hey! And Dudley Stone plunged across the station platform behind me suddenly. Is that you, Mr. Douglas? I whirled to confront this great architecture of a man. Big, but not in the least fat, his legs huge pistons thrusting him on, a bright flower in his lapel, a bright tie at his neck. He crushed my hand, looked down upon me like Michelangelo's God creating Adam with a mighty touch. His face was the face of those illustrated north winds and south winds that blow hot and cold in ancient mariners' charts. It was the face that symbolizes the sun in Egyptian carvings, ablaze with life. My God, I thought, and this is the man who hasn't written in 20-odd years? Impossible. He's so alive. It's sinful. I can hear his heartbeat. I must have stood with my eyes very wide to let the look of him cran in upon my startled senses. You thought you'd find Marley's ghost? He laughed. Admit it. My wife's waiting with a New England boiled dinner. We've plenty of ale and stout. I like the ring of those words. To ail is not to sicken, but to revive the flagging spirit. A tricky word, that. And stout? There's a nice, ruddy sound to it. Stout. A great golden watch bounced on his vest front, hung in bright chains. He vised my elbow and charmed me along, a magician well on his way back to his cave with a luckless rabbit. Glad to see you. I suppose you've come as the others came to ask the same question, eh? Well, this time, I'll tell everything. My heart jumped. Wonderful. Behind the empty station sat an open-topped 1927 vintage Model T Ford. Fresh air. Drive at twilight like this, you get all the fields, the grass, the flowers coming at you in the wind. I hope you're not one of those who tiptoe around shutting windows. Our house is like the top of a mesa. We let the weather do our broom work. Hop in. 10 minutes later, we swung off the highway onto a drive that had not been leveled or filled in years. Stone drove straight on over the pits and bumps, smiling steadily. Bang! We shuttered the last few yards to a wild, unpainted, two-story house. The car was allowed to gasp itself away into mortal silence. So do you want the truth? Stone turned to look at me in the face and hold my shoulder with an earnest hand. I was murdered by a man with a gun 25 years ago, almost to this very day. I sat staring after him as he leapt from the car. He was solid as a ton of rocks. I mean, no ghost to him, but yet I knew that somehow the truth was in what he had told me before, firing himself like a cannon at the house. This is my wife, and this is the house, and that is our supper waiting for us. Look at our view. Windows on three sides of the living room, a view of the sea, the shore, the meadows. We nailed the windows open 3 out of 4 seasons. I swear you get a smell of limes here in midsummer, and sometimes from Antarctica, ammonia and ice cream come December. Sit down. Lena, isn't it nice having him here? Now, I hope you like New England boiled dinner, said Lena. Now here, now there, a tall, firmly built woman, the sun in the east, Father Christmas's daughter, a bright lamp of a face that lit our table as she dealt out the heavy, useful dishes made to stand the pound of giant's fists. The cutlery was solid enough to take a lion's teeth. A great whiff of steam rose up, through which we gladly descended, sinners into hell. I saw the second plate skim by 3 times and felt the ballast gather in my chest, my throat, and at last my ears. Dudley Stone poured me a brew he had made from wild Concord's and had cried for mercy, he said. The wine bottle, empty, had its green glass mouth blown softly by Stone, who summoned out a rhythmic one-note tune that was quickly done. Well, I've kept you waiting long enough, he said, peering at me from that distance, which drinking adds between people and which, at odd turns in the evening, seems closeness itself. I'll tell you about my murder. I've never told anyone before, believe me. Do you know John Otis Kendall? A minor writer in the 20s, wasn't he? I said. A few books. Burnt out by 31. Died last week. God rest him. Mr. Stone lapsed into a special brief melancholy from which he revived as he began to speak. Yes, John Otis Kendall, burnt out by the year 1931, a writer of great potentialities. Oh, not as great as yours, I said quickly. Well, just wait. We were boys together, John Otis and I, born with the shade of an oak tree, touched my house in the morning and his house at night, swam every creek in the world together, got sick on sour apples and cigarettes together, saw the same lights and the same blonde hair of the same young girl together, and in our late teens went out to kick fate in the stomach and get beat on the head together. We both did fair, M and I better and still better as the years ran. If his first book got 1 good notice, mine got 6. If I had 1 bad notice, he got a dozen. We were like 2 friends on a train which the public had uncoupled. There went John Otis on the caboose, left behind, crying out, "Save me! You're leaving me in Tanktown, Ohio. We're on the same track." And the conductor saying, "Yeah, but not on the same train." And myself yelling, "I believe in you, John. Be of good heart. I'll come back for you." And the caboose dwindling behind with its red and green lamps like cherry and lime pops, shining in the dark. And we yelling our friendship to each other. "John, old man. Dudley, old pal." While John Otis went out on a dark siding behind a tin baling shed at midnight, and my engine, with all the flag wavers and brass bands, boiled on toward dawn. Dudley Stone paused and noticed my look of general confusion. "Well, all this led up to my murder," he said. "For it was John Otis Kendall who, in 1930, traded a few old clothes and some remaindered copies of his book for a gun and came out to this house and this room."
"He really meant to kill you?"
"Meant to, hell. He did.
Bang.
Have some more wine. That's better." A strawberry shortcake was set upon the table by Mrs. Stone while he enjoyed my gibbering suspense. Stone sliced it into 3 huge chunks and served it around, fixing me with his kindly approximation of the wedding guest's eye. There he sat, John Otis, in that chair where you sit now. Behind him, outside in the smokehouse, 17 hams, in our wine cellars, 500 bottles of the best. Beyond the window, open country, the elegant sea in full lace. Overhead a moon like a dish of cool cream. Everywhere the full panoply of spring. And Lena across the table, too. A willow tree in the wind, laughing at everything I said or did not choose to say. Both of us 30, mind you, 30 years old. Life our magnificent carousel, our fingers playing full chords, my book selling well, fan mail pouring upon us in crisp white founts, horses in the stables for moonlight rides to coves where either we or the sea might whisper all we wished in the night. And John Otis, seated there where you sit now, quietly taking the little blue gun from his pocket. I laughed, thinking it was a cigarette lighter of some sort, said his wife. But John Otis said quite seriously, I'm going to kill you, Mr. Stone. What did you do?
Do?
I sat there, stunned, riven. I heard a terrible slam, the coffin lid in my face. I heard coal down a black chute, dirt on my buried door. They say all your past hurtles by you at such times? Nonsense. The future does. You see your face a bloody porridge. You sit there until your fumbling mouth can say, but why, John, what have I done to you?
Done?
He cried. And his eyes skimmed along the vast bookshelf and the handsome brigade of books drawn stiffly to attention there with my name on each blazing like a panther's eye in the Moroccan blackness. Done, he cried mortally, and his hand itched the revolver in a sweat. Now, John, I caution, what do you want?
One thing more than anything else in the world, he said.
To kill you
and be famous.
Be known for a lifetime and beyond as the man who killed Dudley Stone? You can't mean that.
I do.
I'll be very famous. Far more famous than I am today, in your shadow. Oh, listen here. No one in the world knows how to hate like a writer does. God, how I love your work, and God, how I hate you because you write so well. Amazing ambivalence. But I can't take it anymore, not being able to write as you do. So I'll take my fame the easy way. I'll cut you off before you reach your prime. They say your next book will be your finest, your most brilliant.
But they exaggerate.
My guess is they're right. I looked beyond him to Lena, who sat in the chair frightened, but not frightened enough to scream or run and spoil the scene, so it might end inadvertently.
Calm, I said.
Calmness. Sit there, John. I ask only 1 minute. Then pull the trigger.
No,
Lena whispered.
Calmness, I said to her, to myself, to John Otis.
I gazed out the open windows. I felt the wind. I thought of the wine in the cellar, the coves at the beach, the sea, the night moon like a disk of menthol cooling the summer heavens, drawing clouds of flaming salt, the stars. After it, in a wheel toward morning, I thought of myself only 30.
Lena 30.
Our whole lives ahead. I thought of all the flesh of life hung high and waiting for me to really start banqueting. I had never climbed a mountain. I had never sailed an ocean. I had never run for mayor. I had never dived for pearls. I had never owned a telescope. I had never acted on a stage or built a house or read all the classics I had so wished to read. All the actions waiting to be done.
So in that almost instantaneous 60 seconds, I thought at last of my career, the books I had written, the book I was writing, the books I intended to write, the reviews, the sales, our huge balance in the bank. And, believe or disbelieve me, for the first time in my life, I got free of it all. I became in one moment a critic. I cleared the scales. On one hand, I put all the boats I hadn't taken, the flowers I hadn't planted, the children I hadn't raised, all the hills I hadn't looked at. With Lena there, goddess of the harvest. In the middle, I put John Otis Kendall with his gun, the upright that held the balances. And on the empty scale, dozen books. I made some minor adjustments. The 60 opposite, I laid my pen, my ink, my empty paper. My seconds were ticking by. The sweet night wind blew across the table. It touched a curl of hair on Lena's neck. Oh, Lord, how softly, softly it touched. The gun pointed at me. I have seen the moon craters in photographs and that hole in space called the Great Coal Sack Nebula, but neither was as big, take my word, as the mouth of that gun across the room from me. John, I said at last, do you hate me that much? Because I've been lucky and you not? Yes, damn it, he cried. It was almost funny he should envy me. I mean, I was not that much better a writer than he. A flick of the wrist made the difference. John, I said quietly to him, if you want me dead, I'll be dead. Would you like for me to never write again? I'd like nothing better, he cried. Get ready. He aimed at my heart. All right, I said. I'll never write again. What? We're old friends. We've never lied to each other, have we? Then take my word. From this night on, I'll never put pen to paper. Oh, God, he said and laughed with contempt and disbelief. There, I said, nodding my head at the desk near him, are the only original copies of the two books I've been working on for the last 3 years. I'll burn one in front of you now. The other you yourself may throw in the sea. Clean out the house. Take everything faintly resembling literature. Burn my published books, too. Here. I got up. He could have shot me then. But I had him fascinated. I tossed one manuscript on the hearth and touched a match to it. No, Lena said. I turned. I know what I'm doing. She began to cry. John Otis Kendall simply stared at me, bewitched. I brought him the other unpublished manuscript. Here, I said, tucking it under his right shoe so his foot was a paperweight. I went back and sat down. The wind was blowing, and the night was warm, and Lena was white as apple blossoms there across the table. I said, from this day forward, I will not write ever again. At last, John Otis managed to say, how can you do this? To make everyone happy, I said. To make you happy, because we'll be friends again, eventually. To make Lena happy, because I'll just be her husband again, and no agent's performing seal, and myself happy because I'd rather be a live man than a dead author. A dying man will do anything, John. Now take my last novel and get along with you. We sat there, the three of us, just as we three are sitting tonight. There was a smell of lemons and limes and camellias. The ocean roared on the stony coastline below. God, what a lovely moonlit sound. And at last, picking up the manuscripts, John Otis took them, like my body, out of the room. He paused at the door and said, I believe you. And then he was gone. I heard him drive away. I put Lena to bed. That was one of the few nights of my life I ever walked down by the shore. But walk I did, taking deep breaths and feeling my arms and legs and my face with my hands, crying like a child, walking and wading in the surf to feel the cold salt water foaming about me in a million suds. Dudley Stone paused. Time had made a stop in the room. Time was in another year. The three of us sitting there, enchanted with his telling of the murder. "And did he destroy your last novel?" I asked. Dudley Stone nodded. A week later, one of the pages drifted up on the shore. He must have thrown them over the cliff. 1,000 pages. I see it in my mind's eye, a flock of white seagulls, it might seem, flying down to the water and going out with the tide at 4 in the black morning. Lena ran up the beach with that single page in her hand, crying, "Look, look!" And when I saw what she handed me, I tossed it back in the ocean. Dudley Stone looked at me steadily. "What would you have done in a similar position? Look at it this way. John Otis did me a favor. He didn't kill me. He didn't shoot me. He took my word. He honored my word. He let me live. He let me go on eating and sleeping and breathing. Quite suddenly, he had broadened my horizons. I was so grateful that standing on the beach, hip deep in water that night, I cried and I was grateful. Do you really understand that word? Grateful he had let me live when he had it in his hand to annihilate me forever. Mrs. Stone rose up. The dinner was ended. She cleared the dishes. We lit cigars and Dudley Stone strolled me over to his office at home, a roll-top desk, its jaws propped wide with parcels and papers and ink bottles, a typewriter, documents, ledgers, indexes. It was all rolling to a boil in me. John Otis simply spooned the froth off the top so I could see the brew. "It was very clear," said Dudley Stone. "Writing was always so much mustard and gallweed to me. Fidgeting words on paper, experiencing vast depressions of heart and soul, watching the greedy critics graph me up, chart me down, slice me like sausage, eat me at midnight breakfasts. Work of the worst sort. I was ready to fling the pack. My trigger was set. Boom. There was John Otis. Look here." He rummaged in the desk and brought forth handbills and posters. I had been writing about living. Now I wanted to live, do things instead of tell about things. I ran for the Board of Education. I won. I ran for alderman. I won. I ran for mayor. I won. Sheriff, town librarian, sewage disposal official. I shook a lot of hands, saw a lot of life, did a lot of things. We've lived every way there is to live, with our eyes and nose and mouths, with our ears and hands. We've climbed hills and painted pictures. There are some on the wall. We've been 3 times around the world. I even delivered our baby son unexpectedly. He's grown and married now, lives in New York. We've done and done again. Stone paused and smiled. "Come on out in the yard. We've set up a telescope. Would you like to see the rings of Saturn?" We stood in the yard, and the wind blew from 1,000 miles at sea. And while we were standing there, looking at the stars through the telescope, Mrs. Stone went down into the midnight cellar after a rare Spanish wine. It was noon the next day when we reached the lonely station after a hurricane trip across the jouncing meadows from the sea. Mr. Dudley Stone let the car have its head while he talked to me, laughing, smiling, pointing to this or that outcrop of Neolithic stone, this or that wildflower, falling silent again, only as we parked and waited for the train to come and take me away. "I suppose," he said, looking at the sky, "you think I'm quite insane." "Nope, I'd never say that." "Well," said Dudley Stone, John Otis Kendall did me one other favor. What was that? Stone hitched around conversationally in the patched leather seat. He helped me get out when the going was good. Deep down inside, I must have guessed that my literary success was something that would melt when they turned off the cooling systems. My subconscious had a pretty fair picture of my future. I knew what none of my critics knew, that I was headed nowhere but down. The two books John Otis destroyed were very bad. They would have killed me deader than Otis possibly could. So he helped me decide unwittingly what I might not have had the courage to decide myself, to bow gracefully out while the cotillion was still on, while the Chinese lanterns still cast flattering pink lights on my Harvard complexion. I had seen too many writers up, down, and out, hurt, unhappy, suicidal. The combination of circumstance, coincidence, subconscious knowledge, relief, and gratitude to John Otis Kendall to just be alive was fortuitous, to say the least. We sat in the warm sunlight another minute, and then I had the pleasure of seeing myself compared to all the greats when I announced my departure from the literary scene. I mean, few authors in recent history have bowed out to such publicity. It was a lovely funeral. I looked, as they say, naturel. And the echoes lingered. His next book, the critics cried, would have been it. A masterpiece. I had them panting, waiting. Little did they know, even now, a quarter century later, my readers who were college boys then make sooty excursions on drafty kerosene, stinking short line trains to solve the mystery of why I've made them wait so long for my masterpiece. And thanks to John Otis Kendall, I still have a little reputation. It has receded slowly, painlessly. The next year I might have died by my own writing hand. How much better to cut your own caboose off the train before others do it for you. My friendship with John Otis Kendall? It came back. It took time, of course, but he was out there to see me in 1947. It was a nice day all round, like old times, and now he's dead. And at last I've told someone everything. What will you tell your friends in the city? They won't believe a word of this, but it is true. I swear it. As I sit here and breathe God's good air and look at the calluses on my hands and begin to resemble the faded handbills I used when I ran for the county treasurer. We stood on the station platform. Goodbye, and thanks for coming and opening your ears and letting my world crash in on you. God bless to all your curious friends. Ah, here comes the train. I've got to run. Lena and I are going to a Red Cross drive down the coast this afternoon. Goodbye. I watched the dead man stomp and leap across the platform, felt the planking shudder, saw him jump into his Model T, heard it lurch under his bulk, saw him bang the floorboards with a big foot, idle the motor, roar it, turn, smile, wave to me, and then roar off and away toward that suddenly brilliant town called Obscurity by a dazzling seashore called the past. The theme of perceptions continues in the next short story by Ray Bradbury, entitled Season of Disbelief. How it began with the children, old Mrs. Bentley never knew. She often saw them like moths and monkeys at the grocer's, among the cabbages and hung bananas, and she smiled at them, and they smiled back. Mrs. Bentley watched them make footprints in winter snow, filling their lungs with autumn smoke, shaking down blizzards of spring apple blossoms, but felt no fear of them. As for herself, her house was in extreme good order, everything set to its station, the floors briskly swept, the foods neatly tinned, the hatpins thrust through cushions, and the drawers of her bedroom bureaus crisply filled with the paraphernalia of years. Mrs. Bentley was a saver. She saved tickets, old theater programs, bits of lace, scarfs, rail transfers, all the tags and tokens of existence. "I've a stack of records," she often said. "Here's Caruso." That was in 1916 in New York. "I was 60, and John was still alive. Here's June Moon, 1924, I think, right after John died." That was the huge regret of her life in a way. The one thing she had most enjoyed touching and listening to and looking at, she hadn't saved. John was far out in the meadow country, dated and boxed and hidden under grasses, and nothing remained of him but his high silk hat and his cane and his good suit in the closet. So much of the rest of him had been devoured by moths. But what she could keep, she had kept. Her pink flower dresses crushed among moth balls and vast black trunks and cut glass dishes from her childhood. She had brought them all when she moved to this town 5 years ago. Her husband had owned rental property in a number of towns, and like a yellow ivory chess piece, she had moved and sold one after another. Until now, she was here in a strange town, left with only the trunks and furniture, dark and ugly, crouched about her like the creatures of a primordial zoo. The thing about the children happened in the middle of summer. I mean, Mrs. Bentley, coming out to water the ivy upon her front porch, saw two cool-colored sprawling girls and a small boy lying on her lawn enjoying the immense pricklings of the grass. At the very moment Mrs. Bentley was smiling down upon them with her yellow-masked face, around a corner like an elfin band came an ice cream wagon. It jingled out icy melodies, as crisp and rimmed as crystal wine glasses tapped by an expert, summoning all. The children sat up, turning their heads like sunflowers after the sun. Mrs. Bentley called, "Oh, would you like some? Here!" The ice cream wagon stopped, and she exchanged money for pieces of the original ice age. The children thanked her with snow in their mouths, their eyes darting from her buttoned-up shoes to her white hair. "Don't you want a bite?" said the boy. "No, child. I'm old enough and cold enough. The hottest day won't thaw me," laughed Mrs. Bentley. They carried the miniature glaciers up and sat three in a row on the shady porch glider. "I'm Alice. She's Jane. And that's Tom Spaulding." "How nice. And I'm Mrs. Bentley. They called me Helen." They stared at her. "Don't you believe they called me Helen?" said the old lady. "I didn't know old ladies had first names," said Tom, blinking. Mrs. Bentley laughed dryly. "You never hear them used, he means," said Jane. "My dear, when you are as old as I, they won't call you Jane either. Old age is dreadfully formal. It's always Mrs. Young people don't like to call you Helen. It seems much too flip." "How old are you?" asked Alice. "Oh, I remember the pterodactyl," Mrs. Bentley smiled. No, how old?" 72. They gave their cold sweets an extra long suck, deliberating. That's old," said Tom. "I don't feel any different now than when I was your age," said the old lady. "Our age?" "Yes. I mean, once I was a pretty little girl, just like you, Jane, and you, Alice." They did not speak. "What's the matter?" "Nothing." Jane got up. Oh, you don't have to go so soon, I hope. You haven't finished eating. Is something the matter?
My mother says it isn't nice to fib, said Jane.
Oh, of course it isn't. It's very bad, agreed Mrs. Bentley.
And not to listen to fibs.
Who was fibbing to you, Jane?
Jane looked at her and then glanced nervously away.
You were.
I? Mrs. Bentley laughed and put her withered claw to her small bosom.
About what?
About your age. About being a little girl. Mrs. Bentley stiffened.
But I was. Many years ago, a little girl, just like you.
Come on, Alice, Tom.
Just a moment, said Mrs. Bentley. Don't you believe me?
I don't know, said Jane.
No. But how ridiculous. It's perfectly obvious. Everyone was young once.
Not you, whispered Jane, eyes down, almost to herself. Her empty ice stick had fallen in a vanilla puddle on the porch floor.
But of course I was 8, 9, 10 years old, like all of you.
The two girls gave a short, quick, sealed-up laugh. Mrs. Bentley's eyes glittered.
Well, I can't waste a morning arguing with 10-year-olds. Needless to say, I was 10 myself once and just as silly.
The two girls laughed. Tom looked uneasy.
You're joking with us, giggled Jane. You weren't really 10 ever, were you, Mrs. Bentley?
You run on home, the woman cried suddenly, for she could not stand their eyes.
I won't have you laughing. And your name's not really Helen.
Of course it's Helen.
Goodbye, said the two girls, giggling away across the lawn under the seas of shade.
Tom followed them slowly.
Thanks for the ice cream.
Once I played hopscotch, Mrs. Bentley cried after them.
But they were gone.
Mrs. Bentley spent the rest of the day slamming tea kettles about, loudly preparing a meager lunch, and from time to time going to the front door, hoping to catch those insolent fiends of their laughing excursions through the late day. But if they had appeared, what would she say to them? Why should she worry about them?
The idea, said Mrs. Bentley to her dainty rose cluster teacup. No one ever doubted I was a girl before.
What a silly, horrible thing to do. I mean, I don't mind being old, not really, but I do resent having my childhood taken from me. She could see the children racing off under the cavernous trees with her youth in their frosty fingers, invisible as air. After supper, for no reason at all, with a senseless certainty of motion, she watched her own hands, like a pair of ghostly gloves at a seance, gather together certain items in a perfumed kerchief. Then she went to her front porch and stood there stiffly for half an hour. As suddenly as nightbirds, the children flew by, and Mrs. Bentley's voice brought them to a fluttering rest.
"Yes, Mrs. Bentley?"
"Come up on this porch," she commanded them, and the girls climbed the steps, Tom trailing after.
"Yes, Mrs. Bentley," they thumped the Mrs. like a bass piano chord,
extra heavily as if that were her first name.
"I've some treasures to show you." She opened the perfume kerchief and peered into it as if she herself might be surprised. She drew forth a hair comb, very small and delicate, its rim twinkling with rhinestones.
"I wore this when I was 9, she said.
Jane turned it in her hand and said, "How nice."
"Let's see," cried Alice.
"And here is a tiny ring I wore when I was 8, said Mrs. Bentley. "It doesn't fit my finger now.
You look through it and see the Tower of Pisa ready to fall."
"Let's see it lean." The girls passed it back and forth between them until Jane fitted it to her hand.
"Why, it's just my size," she exclaimed.
"And the comb fits my head," gasped Alice. Mrs. Bentley produced some jackstones.
"Here," she said, "I once played with these."
She threw them. They made a constellation on the porch. "And here," in triumph, she flashed her trump card, a postal picture of herself when she was 7 years old, in a dress like a yellow butterfly, with her golden curls and blown bluegrass eyes and angelic pouting lips. "Who's this little girl?" asked Jane. "It's me." The two girls held on to it. "But it doesn't look like you," said Jane simply. "Anybody could get a picture like this somewhere." They looked at her for a long moment. "Any more pictures, Mrs. Bentley?" asked Alice. "Of you? Later? You got a picture of you at 15? And one at 20? And one at 40 and 50? The girls chortled. "I don't have to show you anything," said Mrs. Bentley. "Then we don't have to believe you," replied Jane. "But this picture proves I was young. That's some other little girl like us. You borrowed it." "I was married." "Where's Mr. Bentley?" "He's been gone a long time. If he were here, he'd tell you how young and pretty I was when I was 22. But he's not here, and he can't tell, so what does that prove?" "I have a marriage certificate." "You could have borrowed that, too. Only way I'll believe you were ever young," and Jane shut her eyes to emphasize how sure she was of herself, "is if you have somebody say they saw you when you were 10. Thousands of people saw me. But they're dead, you little fool. Or ill. In other towns. I don't know a soul here, just moved here a few years ago, so no one saw me young." "Well, there you are." Jane blinked at her companions. "Nobody saw her." "Listen," Mrs. Bentley seized the girl's wrist. "You must take these things on faith. Someday, you'll be as old as I."
"No, we won't," said the girls.
"Will we?"
they asked one another.
"Wait and see," said Mrs. Bentley. And to herself she thought, "Oh, God, children are children, old women, and nothing in between. They can't imagine a change they can't see." "Your mother," she said to Jane, "haven't you noticed over the years the change?"
"No," said Jane, "she always looks the same."
And that was true. I mean, you lived with people every day, and they never altered a degree. It was only when people had been off on a long trip for years that they shocked you. And she felt like a woman who had been on a roaring black train for 72 years, landing at last upon the rail platform and everybody crying, "Helen Bentley, is that you?" "I guess we'd better go home," said Jane. "Thanks for the ring. It just fits me. Thanks for the comb. It's fine. Thanks for the picture of the little girl."
"Come back. You can't have those," Mrs. Bentley shouted as they raced down the steps. "They're mine."
"Don't," said Tom, following the girls. "Give them back."
"No, she stole them. They belong to some other little girl. She stole them."
"Thanks," cried Alice. So no matter how she called after them, the girls were gone, like moths, through darkness.
"I'm sorry," said Tom on the lawn, looking up at Mrs. Bentley. He went away.
"They took my ring and my comb and my pictures," thought Mrs. Bentley, trembling there on the steps. "Oh, I'm empty, empty. It's part of my life." She lay awake for many hours into the night among her trunks and trinkets. She glanced over at the neat stacks of materials and toys and opera plumes and said aloud, "Does it really belong to me? Or was it the elaborate trick of an old lady convincing herself that she had a past? After all, once a time was over, it was done. You were always in the present. She may have been a girl once, but was not now. Her childhood was gone, and nothing could fetch it back." A night wind blew in the room. The white curtain fluttered against a dark cane, which had leaned against the wall near the other bric-a-brac for many years. The cane trembled and fell out into a patch of moonlight with a soft thud. Its gold ferrule glittered. It was her husband's opera cane. It seemed as if he were pointing it at her, as he often had, using his soft, sad reasonable voice when they upon rare occasions disagreed. "Those children are right," he would have said. "They stole nothing from you, my dear. These things don't belong to you here, you now. They belonged to her, that other you so long ago." "Oh," thought Mrs. Bentley. And then, as though an ancient phonograph record had been set hissing under a steel needle, she remembered a conversation she had once had with Mr. Bentley. Mr. Bentley, so prim, a pink carnation in his whisked, broomed lapels, saying, "My dear, you never will understand time, will you? You're always trying to be the things you were, instead of the person you are tonight. Why do you save those ticket stubs and theater programs? They'll only hurt you later. Throw them away, my dear." But Mrs. Bentley had stubbornly kept them. "It won't work," Mr. Bentley continued, sipping his tea. "No matter how hard you try to be what you once were, you can only be what you are here and now. Time hypnotizes. When you're 9, you think you've always been 9 years old and will always be. When you're 30, it seems you've always been balanced there on that bright rim of middle life. And then when you turn 70, you are always and forever 70. You're in the present. You're trapped in a young now or an old now, but there is no other now to be seen." It had been one of the few but gentle disputes of their quiet marriage. He had never approved of her bric-a-brackery. "Be what you are. Bury what you are not," he said. "Ticket stubs are trickery. Saving things is a magic trick with mirrors." If he were alive tonight, what would he say? "You're saving cocoons," that's what he'd say. "Corsets in a way you can never fit again. So why save them? You can't really prove you were ever young. Pictures? No, they lie. You're not the picture. Affidavits? No, my dear, you're not the dates or the ink or the paper. You're not these trunks of junk and dust. You're only you. Now, the present you." Mrs. Bentley nodded at the memory, breathing easier. "Yes, I see, I see." The gold-ferruled cane lay silently on the moonlit rug. In the morning, she said to it, "I will do something final about this and settle down to being only me and nobody else from any other year. Yes, that's what I'll do." She slept. The morning was bright and green, and there at her door, bumping softly on the screen, were the two girls. "Got any more things to give us, Mrs. Bentley? More of the little girl things?" She led them down the hall to the library. "Take this." She gave Jane the dress in which she had played the Mandarin daughter at 15. And this. A kaleidoscope, a magnifying glass. "Pick anything you want," said Mrs. Bentley. "Books, skates, dolls, everything. They're yours." "Ours?" "Only yours. And will you help me with a little work in the next hour? I'm building a big fire in my backyard. I'm emptying the trunks, throwing out this trash for the trashman. It doesn't belong to me. Nothing ever belongs to anybody." "We'll help," they said. Mrs. Bentley led the procession to the backyard, arms full, a box of matches in her hand. So the rest of the summer, you could see the two little girls and Tom, like wrens on a wire, on Mrs. Bentley's front porch, waiting. And when the silvery chimes of the icicle man were heard, the front door opened. Mrs. Bentley floated out with her hand deep down the gullet of her silver-mouthed purse, and for half an hour you could see them there on the porch, the children and the old lady putting coldness into warmness, eating chocolate icicles, laughing. At last they were good friends. "How old are you, Mrs. Bentley?"
72.
"How old were you 50 years ago?"
72.
"You weren't ever young, were you, and never wore ribbons or dresses like these?"
"No."
"Have you got a first name?"
"My name is Mrs. Bentley."
"And you've always lived in this one house?"
"Always."
"And never were pretty?" Never. Never in a million trillion years the two girls would bend toward the old lady and wait in the pressed silence of 4 o'clock on a summer afternoon. Never, said Mrs. Bentley, in a million trillion years. So from these short stories, I move to Robert Frost. First, his poem, Provide, Provide. The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag, the picture pride of Hollywood. Too many fall from great and good for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate, or if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. Some have relied on what they knew, others on being simply true. What worked for them might work for you. No memory of having starred atones for later disregard or keeps the end from being hard. Better to go down dignified with Boughton friendship at your side than none at all. Provide, provide. And finally, a Frost favorite, Nothing Gold Can Stay. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. Her early leaf's a flower, but only so an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf, so Eden sank to grief. So dawn goes down to day. Nothing gold can stay. I've reached the end of my reading for today, and if you know someone who could use our service, or you're interested in volunteering or donating to our nonprofit to keep us on the air, it is tax deductible. Please call 508-539-2030 or visit our website, audiblelocalledger.org. You can now listen to us on Alexa-powered speakers like the Amazon Echo Dot. Just say these exact words: Alexa, play radio station Audible Local Ledger on TuneIn, and you'll have a clear, static-free connection to our readings. As always, thank you for your continued support. Bye for now.